Good morning, everyone. It's so nice to be greeted in the morning. Welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation. I'm Jen Cates. We're very, very happy to have you here and to have this event today. As probably a good portion of you know, we tried to have this event in January, and it was a victim of a snowstorm. So we were able to reschedule, and I'm happy to say that all of our original panelists were able to be here with us. So thanks so much to them for being willing to make the trip after that. So the purpose of today's event is to examine how the ACA has affected coverage and access for people with HIV, as well as the implications for the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. And for those of us working on this, we know it's critically important to understand who has gained new coverage and who has been left out. It's critically important to understand the implications of state Medicaid expansion decisions. And it's critically important to understand the barriers that still exist. And I think one of the challenges that a lot of us have had is that it's been hard to get information and data on what's happening. I'm happy to say that about 2 years into full implementation of the ACA, there's a lot more data and research that's coming out by many researchers around the country. And actually yesterday, some new research was published in CID that Dr. Laura Cheever was a co-author on. I encourage everyone to look at those articles, but they really show the role of the Ryan White program and changes in coverage. So we're beginning to get information that I think is telling us what's happening for people with HIV and what coverage does do, as well as what's still missing. We at the Kaiser Family Foundation have been working to monitor the experiences of people with HIV, as well as the providers that serve them, by doing field work to understand in their voices and from their experience what it meant for them. So we've released, several research papers from focus group analysis, from one-on-one interviews. We have some video profiles. We've also done some quantitative research looking at other things like the importance of fully assessing the costs of a health plan before signing up for a health plan and how important that is for someone with HIV. What we want to do today is provide you with some background data on a new report that's going to be coming out, and then we'll have more of a discussion about the experiences of the ACA. So the flow will be as follows. First, my colleague Lindsay Dawson, who many of you know, and is an expert on these issues, will present the findings from our new research being released today. Then one of the products, as I mentioned, was video profiles, which some of you probably have seen. We're going to show a snippet from one of them, and the star is actually here as well. And then we'll go to a panel discussion with our panelists. Sorry, I had to do that. With our panelists to have a dialogue and then go to your questions. So that's the flow. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts and everyone's, and I'll introduce the panelists when we get up to that portion of the agenda. So now I'm going to turn the podium over to Lindsay. Lindsay's our senior policy analyst for HIV policy, and she has really led this work and our other efforts around the ACA, including many of the reports that I mentioned. So she is really the lead author on this, and I'll let her share the findings with you. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Jen, and thanks for everybody for being here. We do really appreciate that you were willing to come in both January and May. So as Jen mentioned, I'll be presenting findings from our new brief, and it's in your packets, and it's available on our website now. And it's research that we conducted with Perry Undem Research and Communications, and it really identifies the key findings from focus groups that we did with people with HIV in 5 states. This second round of research that we did was conducted in February, and it explores the impact of the ACA on people with HIV and mostly focuses on the ability to access HIV and non-HIV care. And it's a complement to a report that we released in 2014 with focus groups in the same states. And the focus groups were similarly structured and asking questions about access to care and access to HIV care. But what's different in the second round is that in 2014, coverage opportunities were new. So folks were really entering into these new coverage expansions for the first time. And they were supported by people who were also experiencing these expansions for the first time. And many had not started using their coverage yet. In this 2016 group, we've gone through 3 open enrollment periods, and folks have had 2 years to really engage with insurance coverage. So the groups were set in California, Florida, Georgia, New York, and Texas. And these 5 states were chosen for 2 reasons. One, the 5 states together represent about 50% of the share of the U.S. epidemic. And secondly, the states have taken different approaches to ACA implementation. So while California and New York are states that have expanded their Medicaid program and have created their own state exchanges, Florida, Georgia, and Texas have not expanded their Medicaid program and rely on the federal marketplace. So launching right into key findings, we did note that in this latter group that participants did seem to have a better understanding of basic ACA knowledge and about the coverage opportunities. And this was particularly the case around Medicaid expansion and the penalty. But overall, many still lacked basic insurance literacy. And this makes making really informed purchasing decisions and plan comparisons difficult. Individuals were also not always really clear on what they were eligible for. And so we met a number of individuals who appeared that they might be eligible for Medicaid through a disability pathway, but hadn't really pursued that. And not really understanding your insurance coverage or what your coverage might look like or costs might look like, it affects people in really profound ways. So we met a man in Georgia who was paying $2,000 to $3,000 a month out of pocket for his non-HIV meds. And nobody had really sat him down and said, hey, look, even if you don't qualify for a subsidy, you can probably enroll in pretty comprehensive marketplace coverage, have insurance, and be out of pocket to a lesser degree every single month. One area that we did find more understanding was that people seemed really aware that there's differences in how they can access care across the country. So those in Florida, Georgia, and Texas actually pointed to individuals in other two states, in New York and California, and said, hey, we know people in these states and they have Medicaid expansion, or their ADAP is more comprehensive in how it will wrap around private coverage. And those in New York and California said that they were really very happy to be in the states that they were in and greatly valued the access to coverage they had. We met one man in New York who had just gained Medicaid. He had moved up from the state of Georgia because he didn't have health insurance. He didn't know anybody in New York. He didn't have any other reason to move to the state except to gain health coverage. And he was really grateful to do so. And this is despite being eligible for a subsidy in New York, in Georgia's marketplace. He just said at $200 a month, marketplace coverage wouldn't have been affordable to him. The individuals we met had a wide variety of reasons for enrolling. For many, they wanted the security that could be gained from coverage, but more often than in 2014, individuals cited the coverage mandate or the desire to avoid the penalty. And this makes sense because we know the penalty is being phased in, so it did show some awareness that that message is getting through. As in 2014, case managers continue to play a really important role in helping individuals navigate coverage opportunities. Individuals remain confused about the process and overwhelmed by plan selection. When it came time for plan selection, individuals often looked at costs, primarily at premiums, but they also considered their provider networks and relied on case managers, often to help sort of figure out if they could stay in care where they currently were, and based enrollment on case manager recommendations. But sometimes sort of other factors came up. For instance, one individual said that he had a prior relationship with the insurer and he wanted to stay with that insurer. Another individual in New York's Medicaid program said that he based his decision to enroll based primarily on the ratings on the marketplace. Most of those that we met who were uninsured did look for ACA coverage at some point. But what we learned was they generally looked just once, and they were quite quickly deterred from enrolling. Somebody might see it's too expensive or be told they're not eligible. A couple of individuals asked questions and never really had those questions answered, and so just kind of put the brakes on the enrollment process. And so what we learned is that you really might need a significant push to engage individuals a second time around to consider insurance coverage. Of those that we met, only a few had changed coverage over the course of the three open enrollment periods. So one man in California had initially enrolled in platinum coverage, and he felt like his premiums were too high. And so hoping to reduce his costs, he switched to a gold plan, but was met with higher out-of-pocket costs. And as a result, he's now putting off follow-up care. We met a participant in New York's Medicaid who had enrolled in New York's Medicaid program, and he found out in the mail he got a letter saying his plan was no longer available to him. Presumably it was coming off the market, and he enrolled in a new plan with his clinic's help but has yet to engage with coverage in that new plan. And then a third person we met has really been an example of somebody who's churning through coverage. So he left college where he had college-based insurance. His family encouraged him to enroll in Medicaid, which he did. He found a job and enrolled in the marketplace and got subsidies and ate up premium support, and then lost his job and enrolled into New York's basic health plan. And this individual was really able to navigate this on his own. He was certainly somebody with a lot of initiative, but he did fall out of coverage for 1 month when the enrollment into the basic health plan hadn't really gone through yet. So for those who gained coverage, the participants that we met in New York and California, like in 2014, those with Medicaid and Marketplace coverage generally are very grateful for having insurance. They feel more secure. But both Medicaid and Marketplace enrollees are quite worried about maintaining coverage. For Marketplace enrollees, that's really based on out-of-pocket costs, whereas for Medicaid enrollees, they have a lot of anxiety around recertification and being able to maintain coverage from year to year. Some of the participants that we met who gained coverage said that if they weren't insured, they'd be in worse health, and a few said they would die. And what this said to me was they really don't consider Ryan White to be a safety net that's available to them once they've gained insurance. They sort of forget that the program's there to serve as a safety net for somebody without coverage and without access. Overall, those who gained coverage did feel like their health care was easier to manage and that the health systems were easier to navigate. This contrasts quite sharply with those in Florida, Georgia, and Texas, who were the participants in the focus groups who remained uninsured. Little has changed since we met with uninsured individuals in 2014. All are meeting their HIV care needs through Ryan White, but they suffer from significant health problems unrelated to HIV, and those are typically going unaddressed. Many didn't know about their state's decision not to expand Medicaid, but when it was explained to them, they said they were dismayed by their state's decision, but they weren't surprised. They said that they would enroll if they could. And in fact, several individuals had past experience with Medicaid, which they had when they were pregnant or when their children were younger living at home, and they have a really positive view of the program. So despite feeling like living without insurance is scary and frustrating and wishing they were covered, health insurance really isn't top of mind for this population. Most are unemployed, budgets exceed incomes. They're homeless or they're living with families and friends. Some are struggling with substance abuse, transportation needs, lack food security, or have debt, often because of medical bills, as a result of being insured, sometimes in tens of thousands of dollars. For all that we met, the Ryan White program has continued to play a really important role in the lives of the participants, and the uninsured in particular deeply value the program. Again and again, the uninsured that we met said that they would be dead without the program. The main challenge for most who are engaged with Ryan White is recertification, where just as with the Medicaid program, individuals say it's burdensome and confusing and it's a stressful period for them. Most of those who had gained coverage are now less sure about the role Ryan White is playing in their lives. And this is despite using services like case management, which are support services offered by the Ryan White program and likely funded by Ryan White. And this contrasts quite sharply from 2014, when individuals had just gained coverage and were really sort of bridging out of Ryan White and into private insurance for their HIV care. Some of the uninsured reported that they're quite concerned about how gaining coverage would impact their access to Ryan White, and it seems that a lot of that is about maintaining relationships with their providers. All who we met, both in the Medicaid and Marketplace and who only have Ryan White for their HIV care needs, have a positive view of their providers. They describe deeply personal roles and say their doctors know everything about them. In particular, they like that their doctors are HIV specialists and note how important it is that their providers are aware of the changing science and of the new medications coming to market. And maintaining this active engagement with these providers is really important for them during coverage transitions and is a concern for those who think about moving out of Ryan White and into insurance. One of the most divergent responses we had to focus group questions was, what kind of pharmacy needs do you have? And it really points to the fact that individuals that we met with really see having different types of access to pharmacies as critical to staying engaged with their HIV treatment. So while some prefer a specialty pharmacy or mail order access, others prefer a mainstream pharmacy, saying that it's important to them to have greater discretion, or like a brick and mortar store where they have a personal relationship with a pharmacist. So in sum, what we learned from these groups is indeed the ACA is really changing the insurance landscape for many with HIV, but that's not happening evenly across the population. Those in non-expansion states have limited access. Access to and knowledge about ADAP and other Ryan White support for engagement with private coverage truly varies. Enrollment in affordable health coverage is very variable and is individualized. It's based on individual income, and it's based on the plan selection that an individual might make. And, of course, others are going to remain uninsured unless impacted by these coverage changes. And so I'm thinking about the undocumented or those with just complicated life circumstances that make it really difficult to engage with insurance. For all that we met, Ryan White is continuing to play an important role, especially in the lives of those who remain uninsured, but in providing support services for those who have found coverage. And as we look forward and continue to think about how the ACA is impacting the lives of people with HIV, it'll be really important to continue to improve insurance and coverage literacy so that individuals know what they're eligible for and can engage in coverage that really truly meets their needs. In addition, it's important, as Jen mentioned, to continue to collect data, to take the pulse on the ground, and so that we can really properly inform policy that supports people living with HIV and under the ACA era, and to inform the future of the Ryan White program. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions and answers towards the end of the event when we do an overall Q&A. But I'm going to share with you one of the short videos that Jen mentioned. So in 2014, we did our first round of focus groups. And after we did those, we met with 12 of those individuals and pulled out personal stories and created the profiles report that Jen mentioned. And of those, we found three individuals that we really wanted to highlight their stories to a sort of a higher degree and let them tell their stories in their own words. And one of the people we met with is Shandora. She's here with us today from Atlanta, and she'll join the panel in just a minute. This video was created by Francis Ying and Melissa Majerol in our office, and this is Shandora's story.
My name is Shandora. I've been HIV positive for 26 years, since 1989. My son and I have been at this program that houses women and children living with HIV and AIDS. This program resonates people that's homeless or on the verge of being homeless. I'm a server at a diner. I've been employed there for 7 years, and our place of business does not offer health insurance. I've been uninsured practically for the past 35 plus years. I tried to enroll for the Affordable Care Act. I went to a case manager where I received my treatment at Grady's, and she told me that I did not meet the requirements. I make too much for Medicaid, and I make too less for subsidies for the Affordable Care Act in the state of Georgia. I'm very disappointed in the state of Georgia, and this is just my opinion, because there are other states that offer a lot. I have a history of drug abuse, and during my history of drug abuse, I was receiving HIV care on and off for a lot of years up until 2009. I started receiving consistent care through the Ryan White program here in Atlanta, Georgia. When I came here, I was on 20 pills a day. The last 2 years of my treatment from my wonderful doctor, she has gotten me down to 2 pills a day, once a day. Besides of me being HIV positive, at this point, I have meniscus in my leg. It's not good because I stay on my feet a lot as a server. I work 6 days a week, and the pain is unbearable. I've had cerebral falls on my job. I'm not covered with insurance, and I can't afford out of pocket at this point to pay for the procedures that I needed to be done. Even if I was to get health insurance, my HIV medication is very expensive. It's very expensive. So I'm just trying to hold on to the Ryan White. I got to hold on to that. To lose that, you might as well just go in and dig a hole for Shandora. Ryan White to me is like life at this point. But then on the other hand, health insurance to me would be like another part of my life, because I could stop all the pain that's going on with me.
Thanks, Lindsay. That was really great overview for us. And thank you again. I'm going to start with you, but first I'll do introductions. So we could start with Laura if we need to, but I'll just briefly introduce everyone, and maybe I will go to Laura first. But as you met Shandora Lane from Atlanta, Georgia, and heard a little bit of her story, we just are very grateful that she shared it with us and with you. We know that is hard to do, but so important, because we who work in policy in D.C. know that those voices are really ultimately what make a difference, and also what we're trying to meet those needs. So thank you. We also are really excited to have Dr. Laura Cheever here today, who's the Associate Administrator and Chief Medical Officer of the HIV/AIDS Bureau at HRSA. She oversees the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, which, as we heard, is a lifeline for so many people with HIV, more than half of all those living in the U.S. today. So she'll be able to talk to us about its ongoing role and importance. We're also really excited to have Tim Westmoreland here today, who is a professor from practice at Georgetown Law, where he teaches legislation and statutory interpretation and many other things. He's a longtime friend, and for those of you who might not know him, he's someone who's made a huge difference in the lives of people with HIV, including when he worked for Congressman Waxman in the 80s, working with the congressman to convene the first hearings ever on HIV in the Congress. In the early 80s, not something that was that easy to do. And also more recently, through work with the House, helping to draft the ACA. And he's a Medicaid expert. He actually ran the Medicaid program for a few years in the Clinton administration. So, and then last but not least, we have Dr. John Carlo with us, who's the CEO of AIDS Arms in Dallas, Texas. And AIDS Arms is an AIDS service organization. I'll let him tell you more about it, but what was really interesting to me when I was looking back at the history of it, it was formed in 1985, and for those of you who might know this history about the precursor to the Ryan White program, there were several community-based AIDS service organizations that were funded first by RWJ as models of community-based care that eventually became Ryan White, that really were the demonstrations that showed and made the case to the Congress, to the administration, that we can have a program like Ryan White and it can make a difference. So, and it's still serving clients, and we'll hear more about it. And I particularly want to thank John and Shandora for participating in interviews with us. We're also doing an ongoing project looking at the impact on providers of the ACA. So what is happening with providers? So why don't we start with Dr. Cheever? We'll give you another minute. just broadly speaking, a lot has been happening with Ryan White. Obviously, it is the lifeline. But what are some of the, in broad strokes, changes that are happening with it, or what do people need to know? We heard some things from our findings that some are still not aware of it, that it's available to them. So yeah.
Great. So I did bring a couple of slides just because I thought it would be useful for us to talk about our client-level data. You've talked about the importance of having data. In the Ryan White program, we do collect data from the individuals that we serve at the provider level, and we've now done an analysis where we can compare what's going on in 2014, which was early in implementation, and I'm going to compare this data to 2012. Mm-hmm. We can put that information up there. Okay. I'm going to be in charge.
Yep. There we go.
Great, thanks. So the first thing to note is that in 2014, if you look at the blue slice of the pie, this is the type of health coverage by clients followed by the Ryan White program. And I should say, overall, our program serves 500,000 people. So we serve over 50% of all those people diagnosed in the United States, so huge impact. About a quarter are uninsured. And this is actually not a huge change. I'm going to use 2012 as a comparison because 13 and 14 look very similar. So in 2012, about 28% of all clients were uninsured. So 25% of all clients in Ryan White remain uninsured. The flip side of that story, and why it's important that people that have coverage understand the role of the Ryan White program, is because 75% of people are insured. And prior, it was around that same number. So most people served by the Ryan White program, even prior to ACA, have some form of coverage. And the Ryan White program has played a very, very important role for those people in terms of health outcomes, and continues to play a role. And we've been able to document that both through our data and looking at the Medical Monitoring Project, MMP, looking at people that have Ryan White coverage and people who don't. The other thing about the Ryan White program is that we take care of poor people. This program was really set up to take care of people that didn't have means to get care on their own. And overall, in 2014, two-thirds of the people were living below 100% of federal poverty, and three-quarters were living below 138% of federal poverty. So for those people living in states where Medicaid was expanded, three-quarters of the people served by the Ryan White program would meet income eligibility. So an important thing to remember. What this slide demonstrates, if you look across, is that if you look at the yellow, which is Medicaid, the purple that's right above it, I mean Medicare, the purple, which is Medicaid, and above that is Medicare and Medicaid combined, that among all clients, about 51% are covered by a combination of those two programs, most by Medicaid. And then as you can see, as we go from less than 100% of federal poverty to less than 138% to 139 to 250, that proportion relatively decreases, which I think is what you'd expect to see, but important to remember that most of our clients are going to be less than 138% poverty, and over half are going to be covered by either Medicaid and or Medicare. When we look at outcomes, we know that according to looking at CDC surveillance data, only about 30% of all people living with HIV in this country are virally suppressed, looking at surveillance data. When we look at our data, which are specifically people that have walked into care at least once in the year, so that's a different slice of people, we see that overall the national average in orange is that 81% of all people that walk into the Ryan White program are virally suppressed, which is really amazing because I just told you that most of those people are very, very poor and have a lot of those structural barriers that create health disparities. So something's occurring in the context of Ryan White that's actually helping people. I would postulate that it's those support services and the medical care that we get. You just saw from the study that Kaiser did that people really feel personally connected to their provider, that their provider is really knows a lot about them and is in deep with them in terms of this journey. Many of us with private insurance probably can't tell that story about our medical providers. But if we look that starting on the far left, that people that are completely uninsured, relying just on Ryan White, they have about a 77% viral suppression rate. And people with Medicaid and other public insurance have about a 79% rate. So having insurance does, in fact, look like it makes improvements. Or people with insurance have improved health outcomes. Now, some of this is confounded by things like poverty. We did a study together with the Medical Monitoring Project that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine last year that showed that if people are in care in places that receive Ryan White funding, they're much more likely to have a lot of the support services that we think are important to try to address some of those barriers, structural barriers to good access to care. Things like intensive case management, transportation services, linguistic services, much more likely to occur in the setting of Ryan White. In addition, in that study, they found that for low-income patients, so patients who have less than 100% federal poverty, that the viral suppression rate, if they did not have Ryan White services, was about 67%, and was about 73% if Ryan White services were available. So for the poorest people, having Ryan White made a big difference, and it is, I think, because of that full package that we have. The other thing that another study we did working with people from CDC and the Medical Monitoring Project was also published last year, and it looked at people that just had Medicaid coverage at their provider's office versus people that had Medicaid plus Ryan White, and they found that if they're on a Medicaid-only site, their viral suppression rate, which is about 71%, and Medicaid plus Ryan White in that setting was about 76%. So once again, that having Ryan White in addition to Medicaid made a difference for people. So if you're poor, you're going to do better if you have Ryan White services enabling you. If you just have Medicaid, actually even in private insurance, plus Ryan White, you're going to do better. So an important part of the story. The last thing I'll say, just in terms of some of the data we have, since you were talking about trying to insert data into this discussion, is we were fortunate last year to be able to, or 2 years ago, to do a contract with Apton Associates, where we asked them to look at ambulatory medical care. So in the context of Ryan White program, someone walks into a Ryan White clinic and they just have Medicaid. Medicaid will be billed by Ryan White. We have payer of last resort. Medicaid will be billed. But those people walking in who have Medicaid are going to get a lot of other services funded by Ryan White during that medical visit. And what the study we did with APT was able to really quantify is that typically, when you walk into a clinician's office for a follow-up visit, your visit's going to be 15 minutes long, typically. In the context of Ryan White, your visit's going to be 45 minutes long. And what's going to happen during that visit is they're going to do things like discuss adherence, discuss risk reduction, discuss those issues around housing and connections to care and what are your barriers to care, all those other things that we think are so important to really get people that are significantly underserved engaged in care and retained in care. And so they did demonstrate that, at least in terms of time and content, that is happening. So even though a patient now has Medicaid and they're like, what am I going to do? You know, I just have Medicaid now. Most places they're going to get care, they're getting Medicaid plus Ryan White because there are extra nurses there, there are pharmacists there, there are peer counselors there, there are navigators there. There are people in that setting, because that setting is funded by Ryan White, that even though payer of last resort, Medicaid is being billed for that medical visit and for that, for their medications and labs, Ryan White is paying for a lot of other services that they're getting that's really significantly enhancing their care and improving outcomes. Maybe it's longer than you want to talk, but I just got started there.
Please go.
So final slide. This is just a final set of data here. So when you look at a Medicaid expansion state versus non-Medicaid expansion states, because this is the issue, when you look at our data overall, you see a wash. But if we look at Medicaid expansion on the left, the purple are people that have Medicaid or other public insurance, and that grew significantly from 2012 to 2014, from at 38% to 42%. Exactly what we'd expect to see. I think what we saw in that study that was published yesterday in CID. And then from 2012 to 2014, you also saw a decrease in uninsured from 23% to 17%. So we are not exactly no one who's uninsured. People remain uninsured despite aggressive case management, aggressive payer of last resort kind of requirements in Ryan White. People remain uninsured in places that have expanded Medicaid. And I think we'd expect that. Any large new program that comes into existence, it takes some while to get traction. We saw that with Medicare Part D. Same sort of thing. On the non-expansion sites, states, I have a little bit harder time explaining those data. From 2012 to 2014, there wasn't a really big change in the uninsured, from 34%, from 33% to 34.5%. But the people covered under Medicaid and other forms of public insurance actually decreased from 28% and 25%. And I can't well explain that. I don't think we understand all the issues behind that. I think we can postulate several. But that is a difference we saw. And I'll end right there.
Thank you. I actually really should commend you and your team for those of you who work on data. We know that 2014 data, which actually came out a few months ago, is really recent. So thank you for really pushing and working to get information out quickly. And I know more is coming out. We've talked about it. So it makes a huge difference. That last slide is incredibly telling. Is there anything from yesterday's article that you wanted to highlight, that, or is it really more about that last slide?
I think it's more about that last slide. We looked in that article at places like New York that went to expansion of Medicaid earlier. You see that change earlier. Yeah. And for other states, we're going to see it later because they came on later.
Really important data. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Shandora?
Hey.
Again, thank you. So I guess, you already shared in the video your experience. So if you just want to talk a little bit more about trying to get health insurance, what that's meant, or what might have changed since we talked to you in that video, really, I'll leave it to you to kind of update us or share with us.
Well, good morning. Jen, nothing has actually changed. As a matter of fact, I'm meeting with a navigator next Tuesday to go through the health care coverage once again. But as I explained in my video, when I first started looking for health care coverage, it was the part where I didn't make enough. You know, I was in that coverage gap. And the premiums that they presented to me, it was what they wanted a month, the premium a month, it was something I couldn't afford. And then I look at my Ryan White. You know, Ryan White, like, it's like a vault. I know I got that. It's lock and key. As long as I'm doing what I'm supposed to do to keep my Ryan White insurance available. And when I spoke with my provider, she didn't say don't worry about it. But it was like, well, you know, you got Ryan White. So I guess in my mind, it wasn't so important for me to reach out and get health care coverage because Ryan White meets my needs. Ryan White is so important to me, as I expressed. That's why you see me here today, and I strongly believe that. And I'm so afraid to diligently seek, because if I get my health care coverage, I'm a server. Being a server, you don't know what might happen, you know? And I'm so afraid of losing Ryan White because how about I can't keep my premium? When my Ryan White drops, it takes a process to get it back and to get it back started again.
It's like recertification.
Recertification. Give you an example. My fault, but I was so used to Grady's telling me, well, you know, it's time to recertify. And they didn't. I wanted to pick up my medicine on Tuesday. I can't get my medicine. And I panic. First time in 7 years. I panic. I ran to my doctor. I ran to my PA. You calm down, Chandler. No, no, calm down. I don't have no medicine. What you mean, calm down? So when they finally got me calm, we looked. You were supposed to be here in March. But that's I got complacent with them reminding me. My fault. And see, this is one of my fears, you know, with the process. Luckily, I got my medicine. You know, luckily I got my medicine, and I'm grateful. But yes, Ryan White right now, it's my life. You know, it's a part of my life that I need to hold on to. And like I said in the video, but my health insurance, it will cover a lot of my other needs that I need to be met. You know, I do have an insurance through Grady that gives me limited service. But every time I go to my mailbox, I got a bill. We're talking about, Lindsay was mentioning the medical bills, like the death that you incur. And I don't go to the mailbox every day no more. You know, because I know what I'm going to get out of it. But it is what it is. I'm so grateful for Ryan White. And I am going to continue to look in the marketplace for coverage. And hopefully one day at a time, it will be available where I am fully secured with my Ryan White and my other needs being met.
And one of the things that you talked about in the video that we heard from everybody we talked to is that non-HIV needs are really a big problem, that there's just without coverage. I mean, those are not being able to be met. And people are going without care for really problems that don't have to get significant, but can be quite significant. Yeah. And you've had that experience.
Yes. Yeah. Like I said, I have a torn meniscus. I've failed so many times on my job, get right back up and have to do what I have to do. But the pain is unbearable. You know, Tylenol's, Aleve, even some prescriptions my doctor gave me, they don't help. I went and had the injections about 7 months ago. As I say, I got a medical bill followed behind that. Because, you know, they didn't cover everything. And it's time for me to have the injections again, but I'm just not equipped to go and have another bill on top of that. I want to take care of this one first. So I have to endure a lot of pain because I'm not insured.
Well, one of the reasons we went to Georgia, as Lindsay mentioned, was because it is one of the states that hasn't expanded Medicaid, and Shandora and many others are in this coverage gap, which was not the intention originally of what the ACA was to do. So that brings me to Medicaid and to our Medicaid expert, Tim, who I hope will provide us with sort of a longer view sense of what Medicaid has meant for people with HIV and kind of what it was supposed to happen with the ACA and where we are today.
I think as the resident old guy that I can hark back to some of this because I was working on the AIDS epidemic and before there was Ryan White and before, I think it's important to remind people, before there was the Americans with Disabilities Act also. So in the early days of the AIDS epidemic when there wasn't coverage to be made available, lots of people with AIDS lost their jobs and lost their health insurance. Now, this is on top of all the people who had AIDS who didn't have health insurance to begin with. And so we had this catch-22 that at the time that people most needed health care, they were least likely to be able to have a third-party source of paying for that health care. And Medicaid stepped in. In the early days of the AIDS epidemic, Medicaid was flexible enough that by I think, Jen, you could correct me, but I think by 1990, half of all people with AIDS ended up as Medicaid beneficiaries. Yeah. It was the prime payer for people with AIDS to get health care services. But it's not just, I have to say along the way that it's not just with Medicaid, with AIDS, that Medicaid is so incredibly flexible in meeting urgent national needs. And it wasn't long after that that Medicaid stepped in and became the important payer for the 9/11 healthcare needs afterwards. And then after that, Katrina. And then after that, Sandy. And even today, brand new work on Medicaid and Flint as a way of helping to solve every different healthcare crisis that comes up. It's just such a flexible program to step in and do that. And I assume that we're going to be watching Medicaid and Zika very soon, too, since it's going to be such, that population is going to be so much at risk. So the first thing I want to say is that Medicaid was flexible and it was there even before Ryan White was there, even before the ADA protected people from losing their jobs. And then the second thing I want to say, which was prompted by your story and by your data, is that Ryan White, even in the days of, in the era of Medicaid expansion, continues to do so many things to help Medicaid be better. It's a back and forth symbiotic relationship between Ryan White and Medicaid. That Ryan White is the safety net in those places and in those states that don't do Medicaid expansion. So he continues to be there even if the state legislature and the governors have said, hell no, we're not doing Medicaid. It's always there for people who are immigrants, and the ACA and Medicaid aren't going to be there for them. And it's the safety net under all insurance to make, as you're saying, to make insurance better. That it helps with those situations in which there are strict limits in Medicaid or health insurance, that Ryan White will be able to pay for some of the traditional services that insurance and Medicaid just draw a line on. And on top of that, it will pay for services that insurance and Medicaid never would have paid for, but that are really helpful and, in fact, essential for people with AIDS and people with HIV. So I think of Medicaid as the of Ryan White as the safety net under the safety net. But Medicaid and Ryan White, I think, have a long history together, and they're going to have a long future together.
So it's an interesting perspective to hear you talk about Medicaid as flexible, since one of the big challenges with Medicaid was the eligibility barrier, in a sense, prior to the ACA, which was eliminated by the ACA.
Right.
But given that we all know where we are and that 19 states are still not, have not expanded, what do you see looking forward based on, we won't hold you to this, but but based on prior, I mean, we know with Part D example, there was some resistance beginning, but even Medicaid, when Medicaid, the program was first created, it took a while for all states to come on board. What do you think is likely to happen?
I think as with the Medicaid program at the beginning of Medicaid, with CHIP at the beginning of CHIP, it takes states a while to begin, but sooner or later they all arrive there. There's just so much need, and on top of that, so much money on the table for the federal government that I think ultimately, I pray, ultimately all states will get there. It took a long time for all states to get there with Medicaid. Took a little less time for CHIP, but I think sooner or later they're all going to expand and start to meet the needs that are in the coverage gap right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, John, turning to you, can you tell us a little bit more about AIDS ARMS and kind of what your role is, the population you're serving, or anything you want to share about the history, too, would be
sure.
Great.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for having this program. I think it's really, really critical, given in the time where we are around the ACA and the implementation. Before I start, I just want to say I am in strong support of the ACA, so I'm going to make some comments that might appear to be critical because I think we do have challenges and we have been seeing quite a few in Texas, but I want to just start off by saying I do support the program itself. Our organization is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. We started as a case management organization with a staff of three. Today, we are just over 105 employees, provide medical care at two sites. We have five physicians and three mid-levels, and we're seeing just over 2,000 patients all living with HIV and AIDS. You know, the growth, of course, was really around the notion of Ryan White itself and the comprehensive care and the approach, which I believe is incredibly important to addressing the HIV crisis as a community, but also to address the individual needs of patients so we can achieve the great goals that we're able to do. Just a little bit about kind of, I'll kind of focus on three areas because it's interesting our view and our approach because I look at this at three different domains. First, we're an employer, and we have over 100 employees. And since the ACA has been implemented, our premiums, the first year it was implemented, went up by 56%. The next year by 28%. And we had to redo our program to go from a PPO, which was the good insurance, to a high deductible plan, which basically doesn't cover anything up until $6,300. We're still, even with that, still paying about $7,000 a year per employee. And in fact, we would have been subject to the Cadillac tax, even with that plan, had that not been repealed. So we really struggled, and it was really, really hard for me to have employees come in tears and saying, I can't afford my health care, and I've had to discontinue my care. And for the organization of what we do, that really, really hurt. But we just simply could not afford the benefits that we used to be able to offer employees. As an organization, you know, we are a medical provider. Unfortunately, at the beginning of this enrollment period last year, we could not get into a single exchange network in the area, despite aggressively calling, saying, look, we'll take any rate, just show us a contract, just put it in front of us. They said, no, we're not taking any new providers. We say, well, hey, we're an essential community provider. By law, you have to provide that. And they say, no, we don't even know what that is, but if we do know what it is, we've already got that covered. Thank you very much. And thankfully, we've been able to get into two plans, but I'll tell you, we filed complaints with our Texas Department of Insurance. We filed an Office of Civil Rights complaint on one plan that basically had no infectious disease providers in the entire county of Dallas, despite 18,000 people living with HIV. And in my opinion, that is wrong. And so, you know, even the health plans, they freely admit that their networks are being narrow to cover their bases. And they're also freely admitting, by the way, that their provider directories are incorrect. So we have physicians who we know have died that remain in network. We know the information, some of our providers' prior addresses remain in the provider directory. So we see a lot of challenges around the implementation around the ACA, particularly with the health plans. Last piece is what it's done for our patients. You know, we've had patients with us for 5 to 10 years. They do the right thing, they get on the ACA, and we have to tell them, you're going to have to find another provider if you're going to stay in your plan's network. And that's been very, very hard to have to transfer care where they want to stay with us. They have a relationship with the doctor that they trust in really their care, and we're having to make those hard decisions for patients. We've even just yesterday had somebody call us and say, I can't find a single ID doctor that's in the exchange plan that I've chosen. Will you see me? And we're struggling with that. I mean, do we take somebody as an out-of-network knowing that there's some risk there? You know, we're really concerned about how that impact is going to be. Last thing I want to just mention is on the Medicaid expansion, just because I think it's another piece to this. Those of you familiar with Texas politics, we ain't going to be expanding Medicaid anytime soon. And unfortunately, there's a very politicized process right now that basically is just basically holding us back. I will say, though, that there is a greater problem in that access does not equal coverage. And in Texas, the way the Medicaid system is run now, just as an example, an office visit at our clinic, we get about $35 for that visit. And there was parity originally, but our legislature actually voted to not have Medicare-Medicaid parity. So we're going to be back at the $35 rate. I don't know how we would stay in business if we had to transition all of our uninsured into Medicaid because we simply could not afford to stay in business at a $35 rate. So we're looking at that, how we can do that, but that's a real concern for us. The last thing I'd mention, though, is providers, Medicaid acceptance in Texas is very, very low. About 19% of primary care doctors even take new Medicaid patients. And we even have hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, that don't take Medicaid, at least the managed care plans for Medicaid. And I think that's really wrong. I mean, I really am concerned when we have patients that can't get procedures done and they have to go to places like UTMB in Galveston, 400 miles away, because none of the hospitals in our area will accept the plans. So, you know, again, I think we support the ACA, but, you know, again, I really want us to recognize that there is particular challenges that we're experiencing, particularly in a state that's not expanding Medicaid. Our ultimate goal, of course, is to keep people in care, provide the best care that we can, and I really hope that we really, you know, use the experiences of Ryan White and understanding of how to do this right so that we continue to inform, you know, how to move forward in the best direction.
Thanks for that sobering reality. One follow-up question. You mentioned patients that are moved into a marketplace plan and your dilemma about seeing them, and that's because you're not in the network, and that's the main reason and the cost implications and risk.
Right, and the other concern, of course, you know, if insurance assistance for Ryan White would really, I don't believe, cover out-of-network subsidies or support. So you're kind of in additional loss. I think if you're, you know, and it could be derived in our
right.
own area, but there has to be decisions about copay coverage and costs right. like that. And generally, we see a void in out-of-network costs as something that wouldn't be covered
right.
under assistance program.
Okay. Do you have anything that people should know about that, or is it really? And I think it points to an issue that it's very locally determined.
Right. So it is very locally determined. Certainly, in the context of Ryan White, if someone has insurance. So a lot of some places that have not expanded Medicaid, the Ryan White program, particularly the ADAP program, has still entered heavily into purchasing insurance mm-hmm. for people. So in those settings, Ryan White does pay for a lot of out-of-pocket costs, including depending on why someone is going out of network and sort of what the rationale is, helping mm-hmm. out across the board.
Okay. Shandor, one other question for you. You mentioned that you began interacting with Ryan White like seven, how many years ago was it now?
Consistent,
yeah,
7 years
okay.
ago. I, as he was saying about Medicaid, I was on the Medicaid when I first got diagnosed and started seeking treatment, and they did cover. And then, you know, like I said, my history of substance abuse would not allow me to continue mm-hmm. staying with the Medicaid. So, my fault of my own. But 7 years ago, consistently with Ryan White, mm-hmm. it is the best thing. It's absolutely heavenly for Shandora. in all sense of the word. You know, I don't idol any gods, anything. I believe in God, but I'm just dead without Ryan White. I know it, you know, because I couldn't afford my HIV medications. Yeah. And that's a big part of my life, mm-hmm. staying alive at this point. You know, I have a 17-year-old that I got to watch over right now, you know, mm-hmm. and that's all I have. And I'm just so grateful. I'm eternally grateful for Ryan White.
So one of the perspectives we don't have represented up here, and it's something that we're actually going to be doing more work on, is when we did these focus groups and interviews, we also included New York and California. And no one from New York and California is here, but we heard a very different story. And as Lindsay was telling you, and if you go back to our reports, one of the other things that we ascertained after talking to folks, because both of those states already had fairly generous Medicaid programs prior to the ACA and fairly generous benefits in general, a lot of the individuals we contacted weren't really aware of a major shift. There was a shift in payer, and that often presented a challenge for them in terms of certification, recertification, maybe changing networks. But in terms of getting things that they couldn't before, that was much less of a change, and I think it was very telling. So what we're wanting to do in our next look at some of this and next look at the field is to go to states where that wasn't the case, states that have expanded Medicaid, but prior to the ACA really had very limited Medicaid coverage. So an individual who was poor but not yet disabled and met the income qualification but was like an adult without dependent children, for example, would not be eligible. A state like that where people were effectively shut out of Medicaid and then all of a sudden were eligible. So we're going to try to get that experience because I think we'll hear some different things that we haven't heard before, people having Medicaid coverage for the first time or going back into Medicaid and see what that meant, and then also the ongoing role of Ryan White. So I think we're now up to the point where we're going to get to turn to folks in the audience. And first, actually, I'm really pleased
today that we have Dr. Amy Lansky with us, who's the acting director of the Office of National AIDS Policy. She's been the acting director for 6 weeks. And we're really grateful that she came and has been here the whole time and is staying with us. We know that you're very busy. One of the things that you're doing, and you worked with your predecessor, Douglas Brooks, to launch an update of the National AIDS Strategy that was very innovative and visionary and looking forward, and now you're in this rest of the Obama administration working to implement as much as you can. So we appreciate you taking some time to talk to us. And we're just hoping you could share some words about the strategy and what you're trying to do, and then anything related to what we've heard today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
So you can come up. Yeah, sure. Please.
Good morning, and it's nice to see you all here. It kind of brings me back to the blizzard, and I'm glad we're having nicer weather. And I also wanted to say thanks to Jen and the team here at the Kaiser Family Foundation for hosting this event, and also for their commitment to issues around the Affordable Care Act and the Ryan White program, and really making sure that all of us understand both of these, I think, kind of complicated topics. So thank you for being our educators. I did want to take a couple minutes to talk about the strategy. We have made a lot of progress over the past 8 years in terms of policy, in terms of science, and our programs in HIV prevention and care. And in our current administration, we have just over 8 months to help solidify that and make a lasting impact. As Jen said, last summer we released the strategy, and it has really guided our work over the past year. And it will serve as a roadmap through 2020 and allow for, I think, a seamless transition across administrations, because it's very clear what needs to be done. And I think it can transcend some of the politics, she said, hopefully. But so one of my important roles is to do this, which is to talk about the strategy and what we're doing. And I think the strategy makes it really clear that people living with HIV and people at risk for HIV need healthcare coverage. And really taken together, the provisions of the Affordable Care Act and the Ryan White program are really a powerful cornerstone of our response. And one of the things in the strategy is it calls for seamless systems to link people into care. And this requires continuity of coverage, including through the Ryan White program, with, as we've talked about today, assistance with enrolling in coverage and also premium payments, and certainly the retention in care with the provisions under the Affordable Care Act and the safety net of Ryan White are really critical for reaching this goal. And one of our other goals in the strategy is around reducing disparities. And I think clearly access to coverage and care is an important way that we're going to be able to address the disparities. And the role for the Ryan White program, I think Shandora is our greatest advocate to talk about that, but her enthusiasm is also reflected through Congress and the administration. There's really been strong support for the Ryan White program, and I think that as we continue to see and document its successes, that will continue that. So we're working on 4 priorities this year in the Office of National AIDS Policy, and it's related to some of the things that have been talked about today. So we're promoting testing and linkage to care and linkage to prevention services for those who test negative, and certainly the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and continued provision of services through Ryan White are critical to these efforts. We're focusing our resources where the burden of HIV is greatest, and I think that the way some of the Ryan White funds are distributed is a really great example of that, and how we need to be sure that we have adequate resources and are putting our money where that burden is highest. We're developing 3 additional indicators to help monitor the strategy, and these include uptake of PrEP, HIV stigma, and HIV among transgender transgender persons. And these reflect important groups and key issues that are really critical for the success of the strategy. And lastly, we're doing our part to address the opioid epidemic in the United States. And doing our part means helping to prevent HIV outbreaks and addressing some of the increases in viral hepatitis transmission. And I think that linkages within the Ryan White program to substance use disorder treatment for hepatitis C in co-infected people are going to be important aspects of achieving these goals. And so lastly, what I want to do is just urge all of you here today, those of you on the panel, those of you in the audience, to really think about what you can do to help us fully implement the Affordable Care Act, to maximize the benefits of the Ryan White program. And it's really going to take all of us working together with our resources and our policies and our programs to help achieve the goals of the strategy. So thank you.
Thank you. I actually want to just add one thought about the strategy. And we also have Jeff Crowley here, who is the original architect of the strategy, as the first ONAP director under President Obama. If, for those of us who work also on issues outside the U.S., on global HIV, there's been strategies in the global sphere for a while that, you know, some of them don't always work, but there's always guiding strategies, at least normative principles and ideas that have been put out there that countries are supposed to aspire to. And it was really a challenge that we hadn't had that in this country. So starting to get that in 2010 and to now have it carry through, and as you said, it hopefully can transcend a change in administrations, because it really is something that, while we might not achieve everything in it, having that normative framework and that structure is really important for ending an epidemic. So thank you. And I take to heart what you said about figuring out what we all can do. So now it's time for all of your questions. What we'll do is we'll take three at a time. If you have a question for a specific panelist, please let us know. If not, we'll turn it over after the three. And just identify yourself. Thank you. And there's mics going around. So, Carl.
Yeah. Hi, Carl Schmid. So, Shandor, I wish we could bring you to the Hill, to your Georgia delegation, to talk about the importance of Medicaid expansion and the importance of the Ryan White program. But I guess my question is really for Laura, because, you know, Shandor talked about her, reliance on Ryan White, and she doesn't have health insurance. But, you know, the Ryan White program, as you said, can pay for premiums for health insurance. So I was just wondering, how is Georgia, you know, doing that? And she also talked about her other needs, and your study did this as well, you know, the co-pays for, you know, other medications or other surgeries or whatever you may require. What can Ryan White do? Can they pay the co-pays and deductibles for other services?
Okay, thanks. Next question.
Hi, my name's Marnie, and I am an attorney, and I used to work in rural Mississippi doing legal services for folks who had HIV and AIDS and faced employment, housing discrimination, access to medical care, and I partnered with doctors. So I formed a medical legal partnership with doctors who serve low-income patients, who are my low-income clients, and we work together. So I'm hoping that folks on the ground are working together with attorneys and doctors. Just want to put that plug in. Mm-hmm. But second is I also worked in Botswana as a Peace Corps volunteer under the PEPFOR program, helping folks with HIV/AIDS in rural Botswana. And I was able to get people on HIV/AIDS medication better and easier in my village with no electricity and no water in Botswana than I was in Mississippi. And most of it is because in rural areas, the treatment focus in rural Botswana was getting doctors to villages. They'd have mobile clinics, and we'd all sit under a tree, and we knew what day to come, and we'd have 15 people there, and they got their medication. In Mississippi, the hospitals, which, as you know, in rural areas are closing, would be up to 100 miles away, and people who don't own cars cannot get there. And if you have 10 different people with doctor's appointments on 10 different days, I couldn't get everyone there. So I'm wondering if we have an idea of changing our treatment systems here in the States as well.
That's a good question. Ron.
Ronald Johnson from AIDS United. Appreciate all of the panelists, but want to focus in on Tim Westmoreland's comment about the synergy between Medicaid and the Ryan White program. Entitlement reform has always been on the in the air, and it appears in probably in the next few weeks we might see another proposal around block granting Medicaid. And I was wondering if you could comment on what projected impact a block grant approach to Medicaid might have on coverage, particularly given the differences between Medicaid expansion states and non-expansion states, and how block granting Medicaid might play out in that scenario.
Great, thank you. So just also in case it was hard. So one question I think primarily for Laura was about what can Ryan White do in Georgia for a situation like Shandora to maintain her Ryan White access but also provide a fuller complement. Is that what are the possibilities? Second was this issue, not just the importance of linking providers and attorneys, but why is it easier to get antiretroviral treatment in rural Botswana than in rural Mississippi? I don't know if anyone here has the answer, but that is a good question. And last, I think a really important issue is the block granting of Medicaid comes up again and again. What would that actually mean, and how might it play out in the current environment? So,
I guess I'll start then.
Yeah.
So I guess starting with Carl. So certainly we have provided a tremendous amount of technical assistance to ADAPs in particular, but also Part A and B grantees to look at buying insurance. And so they, by statute in terms of ADAP, it's got to be cost effective to buy insurance. But we definitely have encouraged states to do that. There are a lot of politics around different states and capacity. But I do think that that all states are really looking at that very closely and moving towards doing that. In that, we have been very clear that Ryan White funds can be used to pay co-pays and deductibles. There is, on the AIDS drug assistance side, so on the ADAP side, it's relatively easier because they're often dealing with pharmacy benefits managers and that sort of thing. On the, like, how do we pay a copay or deductible to a specific clinician's office is much more technically complicated. So jurisdictions are working on that and moving in that direction, but it is a jurisdiction. They can. Yeah, we have a policy clarification notice we put out 2 years ago that outlines all of that. That's something that we would encourage them to do if they can afford to do it. The HIV/AIDS Bureau do have a part that we play in PEPFAR, and we are very interested in making sure that we have information flowing both directions in terms of what we can learn from places like Botswana or Uganda or other places that have done it very well in terms of what we do here. So that's something we're working on. The U.S. has an incredibly complicated healthcare system. I mean, I don't even call it a system, a healthcare environment. And so that is really tough because a lot of what case managers do is they try to help clients negotiate or navigate, you're saying meeting with navigate how to get through that. So we do have lessons to learn. We do have lessons learned. And there are a lot of, I think, best practices when you look at rural communities about telemedicine, the ECHO project out of New Mexico, other things. There are some really great things that have been done and can be done to reach people. Frankly, the issues of stigma in the U.S., it's not a generalized epidemic. You know, in Africa where it is, there's still stigma. But stigma here is a tremendous problem. Yes. So in a lot of rural areas and in Indian reservations and certain communities, people do not want to get care in their community. They would rather go to a different community and get care than get care in their community where they're going to see their auntie at the blood draw station and they're going to see a distant cousin at the pharmacy. They don't want to do that. So that's another layer that we haven't really talked about here that significantly impacts our ability for people to access care.
Yeah. Thanks. Just to Carl's question really quickly, we did a study looking at that very issue, what are states, localities doing around purchasing, helping to purchase insurance, and found a tremendous variety of responses and a lot of confusion. But just as Laura said, the politics were a big barrier, where some of the local Ryan White grantees were very much willing to do this and were not allowed to do it. Others just not really understanding the policy, the permission really to do it. So there was a lot of confusion. It's definitely an area where there could be more clarification, but it's community by community. Yeah, John.
You know, one of the concerns I have on that, we don't want the insurance process to create more barriers for patients living with HIV. And so while we all get the vision that having full coverage is a better option, I worry sometimes because insurance literacy is so challenging. It's such a complicated system that it may not be the right choice for everybody. And particularly if you're having to come in with a program that subsidizes their retaining coverage, while it can be done, you can do premium assistance and copay assistance and all this. I just think we have to be careful that doesn't create a layer of complexity that might have people drop out of care. And I think the political points that we've just been talking about in Texas, absolutely. Nobody wants to go online and say, hey, I'm supporting Obamacare by paying state funds into keeping their coverage. We're not quite there.
I have a lot of comments. First, medical legal partnerships. I have to say I do teach at a law school. Medical legal partnerships are very interesting and innovative things, both for law students and med students, for lawyers and doctors working together. Georgetown is now working on one on oral health in the district for medical legal partnerships. And one of my former students is now working on one about lead poisoning and medical legal partnerships. Those of you who don't know them, investigate law schools and medical schools working together to try to solve systemic problems for health and public health. They're really great programs. They've been around for a while, but they're just beginning to blossom. As far as the question of Mississippi and Botswana, and a little bit in response to your comments earlier about Texas, I mean, I think these are evidence of the ongoing struggles within the federal government writ large, but in Medicaid particularly, about what is federalism. None of the problems that you've described is a federal law problem. They're all about implementation at the state level. Medicaid is, as I'm a broken record, but Medicaid is so flexible, it would solve under reimbursement. It's not the feds that are stopping reimbursement levels. It would stop, I mean, obviously, expansion and non-expansion, structure of the networks. Medicaid allows for a successful solution for all of these things with full federal participation. It's the problem with federalism here. We tried at one point in the ACA to expand Medicaid on a federal basis, and the Supreme Court stopped us in that instance. So there are just some political and legal limits to how far the federal government and Medicaid can go under the current structure of federalism. In response to your question about block granting, see above all those problems about federalism, and also that they just get worse. It just exacerbates here. I would point out the block grant discussion has been around for a very long time, as you said. It is important for states to recognize that the only way that the federal government gets savings in the budget, which is why people say that in Washington say they want a block grant, is if the states don't get as much money as they would have gotten under a traditional Medicaid program. So if they're left holding the bag, they can have fuller control over the program, which I think only drives in the Mississippi and Texas kind of direction of underserving and underpaying. I did take some comfort in the fact that during the last round of the 50 or so ACA repeals that the Congress has done, that there were Republican senators, who said that they had to be sure that the repeal vote did not include repealing Medicaid because their home states had expanded Medicaid and it was working, and that their state couldn't have the rug pulled out from under them. So I do take comfort that there are some Republican senators who have recognized, at least at the beginning, that Medicaid has some benefit even in red states. Finally, you asked me to prognosticate. Mrs. Clinton has a very strong record during the Clinton administration of opposing Medicaid block grants. She was a very strong opponent during her husband's administration. Mr. Trump has been less clear about his stances on Medicaid, but I have to add that New York values would say support the ongoing structure of Medicaid and see how much federal money you can get out of it. So I'm hoping that his New York values prevail in that instance. So,
thank you. Next round of questions. Over here, back there, and then over here. Oh, great. That's fine. We'll...
Hi, I'm Elaine from the Congressional Research Service. And I'm wondering if there's any research on the effects of allowing young adults to stay on their parents' health plans to the age of 26, if some of them were perhaps avoiding care because they're worried about the explanation of benefits being sent to their parents.
Oh, boy.
Good
question.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bernarda from House of Health Medical Clinic. My question goes to Mr. John. You said you're a great supporter of ACA, right? Myself, I also support ACA. And one of the objectives of ICA is to close the gap between the insured and uninsured. And the ACA has been adopting different strategies to try to close the gap. And currently, from the current data, just like the one we just saw from Ariane White, now the gap between the insured and insured and uninsured is still on the high side. So my question is, do you predict the future of 0% uninsured population in America?
We'll come to you the next round. We'll take one more question this round after Andrea. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Andrea Waddell with the HIV Medicine Association. Dr. Carlo, thank you for your comments. They were sobering, but really reinforced the work that some of us are doing to try to make the ACA work better. And my organization represents HIV providers, so particularly, you know, discouraged to hear the news about the networks in Texas. And I'm wondering what, you know, at the federal level or national level, sort of what recommendations you have for Dr. Cheever or CMS, if there's anyone here from CMS, for how we can improve that and ensure that Ryan White providers are included in the exchange networks. Thank you.
Thanks. And our last question for this round.
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for this presentation from Kaiser. I always look forward to your leadership in this area. It's really great to have you around. Anyway, my question came from Laura. She mentioned that the people that seem to have access to both Ryan White and Medicaid seem to be doing better. And I wonder why that's true, because the reason I worry about that is because we have many jurisdictions that have expanded beyond federal requirements, so we're moving more people from Ryan White into Medicaid. And so that would imply that if we're doing that, there might be an issue about quality of care.
Thanks. Okay, so just some, we have a question about young people and the explanation of benefits going to their parents or guardians if they're still on their health plans. The second is a prediction, will there ever be 0% uninsurance in the United States? And then lastly, I'm missing one, the provider network issue. And then lastly, this question, is there a risk there if clients are really moving primarily to Medicaid, and I think it gets back to some of the things we were talking about. Ryan White can still play a role. So I'll just turn it over. The EOB question and young people, anyone want to talk about that? Yeah.
We have seen that. I don't have any data specifically on that, but it particularly came up around PrEP. We've had young adults come in seeking PrEP but don't want that information on would be received. So we've seen it anecdotally, but I don't have any data on it.
Yeah, the thing I would add is that I think where you can, the people that are further ahead than we working in HIV are the STD people, people that treat STDs, I think have done a lot of work and thought in that area, and I would turn to them to see what kind of data there are.
Great. Okay, other question about will we ever get to 0% uninsured in the United States? Anybody?
You know, I will say this before. I think we've seen some movement and some improvement, even in a non-Medicaid expansion state such as Texas. We've actually noticed our number of insured patients and clients has increased by about 10% over the last 3 years. It's actually not because of exchange plans. So we have very few clients on exchange plans. What I think is happening is because the economy is improving in Dallas, because people are healthier, people are working, there's more employee-based coverage, so that there is more affordable options out there for people. I don't necessarily look into the future and say we would achieve 0%, but I'd certainly like to get less than the 39% that we're currently faced in Dallas, Texas.
And I would say I doubt that we'll ever get technically to zero. First of all, and most obviously, because the federal and state systems both treat immigrants very badly. And as long as we have a substantial immigrant population, both legal immigrants during their five-year ban and undocumented people who will always be treated badly by the statute as they exist, we're going to have a substantial uninsured problem. But secondly, having said that, I don't think it's bad to aspire to that. And for that, I would point you towards our coverage for children. We have made remarkable progress in reaching almost zero uninsured children for eligibility. It's always a problem between Medicaid and CHIP and private health insurance. Almost all children in America, except the immigrants, should have some access to insurance. It's a problem to get everybody who's eligible enrolled, But we've made remarkable progress when we put our mind to it and gotten our country together around health care for children. And I think we can aspire to it for everyone.
Thanks. And then this question about networks not taking essential community providers.
Yeah, I've got two, and I'm glad you asked that. So the first one of the things we noticed, and I think it's a gap, is during the open enrollment period, the health plans were very in transition in terms of what their provider networks are going to be. So if you're a consumer and you're going on the network to make change, and you're looking for whether or not your doctor's in the plan, they're saying, well, we don't have all that up. So there's a gap there in terms of health plans having accurate provider directories during the time of open enrollment. I mean, that just makes sense, right? The consumer needs to have the accurate information. The second thing is, the reason we have not been able to get into the networks and what they're telling us, the little sort of dirty little secret is this. They only want to work with primary care providers that are affiliated with the mm-hmm. hospitals that are in their network. So they're not telling us this as when we're calling, but when we finally get to the bottom of the health plans, they're saying, because you're only privileged to this hospital, we don't want to work with you because we don't want you to refer to an out-of-network hospital, right? Which makes sense. And then they say you can just go get your providers, get privileges at all the hospitals in the area. It's not feasible. So one of the second thing we have to look at is how we can perhaps encourage our hospital systems, which most of them are nonprofit, to taking exchange plans and not dragging their feet on getting into these networks.
I don't know if, Laura, you want to add anything about Ryan White's role, but a lot of what we're hearing is not a Ryan White
right.
problem. It's much bigger than that. Yeah. So, anything on the essential community providers that the federal government can remind?
Well, I think we continue to try to improve, even making sure that everyone that's in the Ryan White program is listed in that essential community provider list, and making sure that list is up to date and accurate as different as different insurers are coming to look at that list and who's on that list. So that's something we've done a lot of work with in the last couple of years.
I think there was one last question about this issue of states going beyond and having very broad, you know, very high levels of eligibility for Medicaid. Will that implicate quality?
So I think the important issue there really gets back to one of those studies that was published last year with the Medical Monitoring Project data, is that If a clinic is receiving Ryan White funds, they have lots of other services there that to help support that patient be successful in care. So as Medicaid expands, if people are still going to places that are supported by Ryan White, then even though their Medicaid is paying for their doctor and their medications and their labs, Ryan White is doing a lot of other things during that patient visit and for that patient. On the other hand, if someone's in a particular part of Medicaid managed care where they have to go to a certain provider that is not really affiliated with Ryan White, doesn't know how to make those referrals and connections in the community, then I do think that they're not going to have those benefits that they currently get by going to provider that takes both Medicaid and has Ryan White funds and services available. So I think that's the key, is really as individuals are getting different types of insurance, and I think you brought this up too, that they need to be cognizant in a way that they're not right now about what are the services that are going to be available at that particular site that can help support me beyond just getting a prescription from a clinician, which is like the bottom rung of access to care.
And this, Shandor, this is what you were saying. You're concerned about if you are able to secure coverage, wanting to make sure that Ryan White is still in place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. I think we have time for maybe two other questions. One here, yes, and one here. Oh, and we'll do three because we neglected that side of the room. So we'll do one, two, and then three.
My name is Emeko Jo. I'm a member of Water and Gas Conference, and I was invited by Mr. Bernard. I've listened diligently because this is a different field from where I work. I've listened diligently to the analysis, the questions asked. But one question I want to ask is this. Is there no way the federal government or the state government can get the price of AIDS or HIV-related medication so low that she could still be on Ryan White and still be able to afford other other medications?
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Soli. I work with the Maryland State Aid App. My question is, where is the intersection in terms of care? Like, when you have someone enroll into an ACA, it kind of piggybacks off this gentleman's question, where you have a client who's wanting to get case management or now has to go under their health plan, and what they consider to be case management is not Ryan White case management. And that's just one example and how that really can be a barrier in itself. So we're advocating and telling clients to get into this ACA program, but then the services, kind of speaking to what you were saying, is not fulfilling all of their needs, and then that becoming a deterrent. And is there, and do we foresee, or the panelists foresee, a way that we can have the insurances adopt more of a Ryan White model, not exactly the same, but more of a Ryan White model, to meet those comprehensive needs of the client?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Yeah, and we will...
I am Anil Pandya from the Health Council of Southeast Florida in Palm Beach County. And my question is specifically for Dr. Cheever. One of the themes today has been the sort of the gap for non-HIV-related conditions among the uninsured. So as the longevity increases with and the viral suppression has been decreased, it seems like the chronic conditions are certainly one of the primary concerns. So I know the Ryan White Care Act allows for the provision of medical services for HIV-related conditions. I would just like to hear your basically your take on the interpretation of that term. I would be a proponent of a more broad interpretation in the spirit of whole health as the epidemic has sort of evolved over the years.
Thanks. And one last question, but then we're going to have quick answers. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm Stacy from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and we're interested in hearing what you have to say today because there's a lot of intersection. We have high Medicaid population. About half of our patients are served by Medicaid or public programs, and we have some really expensive drugs. And in my previous life, I was on a national plan, so I know that HIV drugs are increasingly being reclassified as specialty therapies. And I was just wondering if this is impacting patients' coverage decisions, and also what strategies are being considered to deal with this.
Wow, these are big questions. well, there's something on drug prices, and then I would say throw in the specialty care question of tiering there, case management issue, and then how broadly the Ryan White interpretation is. Who wants to start with drug pricing or tiering? I'm looking at Tim.
I can't answer it quickly. I mean, it's a problem not just for people with HIV, but for people in all kinds of diagnoses with the advent of new treatments. As you suggest, it's a problem with a lot of other situations as well, and it's a problem not just for the Ryan White program or the Medicaid program. It's a problem for Medicare and private insurers. We should have another discussion on that topic.
In short, there's no standard pricing across even government programs, and driving them lower is very hard. Yeah. On the tiering, anybody want to take that?
We see this. It is a challenge.
Yeah.
I think we've recognized it. I mean, we'd need another panel discussion to even go into all of that. It's the problem I see is how fluid it is, how much it changes even mid-plan here. It's a disservice to the consumer.
Really quickly, and Carl from AIDS Institute is here, and Lindsay on my team did some work on this as well. This has been an issue that's been brought to the attention of the federal government and states. And on a state level, there's been progress in saying that practice is not to put all HIV antiretrovirals at a highest tier does not abide by the ACA principles, and actually there's hope that some guidance will come out to reaffirm that at some level, but it is an ongoing issue, but it would have direct implication for the population you're talking about for sure. Case management? I think the question was around people getting a different, getting less than Ryan White case management.
Right. So I don't have an answer to the question of how do we get insurers to move to that?
Yeah.
Because that is something that's generally not been covered by insurance. I think as we look for value-based financing and that you need to look at good outcomes, then that will, I think, push insurers in that way because case management is critically important to very vulnerable populations. But once again, we talk about payer of last resort, that if a patient enters a Medicaid managed care program where they have what they call case management, which is one case management for 5,000 clients, That is not the same thing as what we talk about in Ryan White in terms of intensive case management. So certainly someone could be receiving case management as a covered service under Medicaid and still be getting case management through Ryan White, because those are two very different and distinct services. And as long as that can be well articulated, I don't think you have a payer of last resort issue. Mm-hmm. So we do expect that Ryan White will continue to provide that intensive case management they provide for people that are getting a different type of case management, really a completely different type of service through their insurance.
You want to add something on that?
You know, and this is something where I actually do see an opportunity. Because we are familiar with, you know, case management and how effective it can be, we sat down with a health plan, presented them this exact concept, that, you know, the whole health concept, the medical home concept. They actually did their homework, so they knew exactly how much we cost compared to the private practice offices, and they were very, very happy to talk to us. So because we're a lot less in terms of what our costs are. So I think that there is some opportunities that are right here. We just have to think about the strategy, about how we effectively implement and really sell what we offer to the health plans.
And just, I think this is, relates to the question over here around the, how broadly Ryan White can be interpreted to support whole health. But I think you already kind of touched on it. You can pay for co-pays and premiums for health insurance. That would obviously provide a broader set of,
right,
of services.
Right, when we look at sort of HIV-related services, given that HIV causes inflammation, which causes early, which causes increased rates of all sorts of things for even, you know, lung disease, liver disease, kidney disease, that you could have a very broad interpretation. And that really is something that sort of happens at a state and local level, depending on resources available and what they think they can cover. But as a systemic disease, it can be quite broad.
All right. Well, clearly we could have a few other panels on some of these issues. Maybe we will. I'm going to actually ask Shandor to maybe say one last thing, which is because someone had said, well, we wish we could get you on the Hill to talk about what you would say about Ryan White. And after today and thinking, what would you say if we said right now we're going to go? No, we're not going to take it. just, you know, what would be the message that you would want to bring about your experience?
My experience, not, I want to understand the question right. It's my,
the importance of Ryan White in your life.
Oh, I don't say it.
Okay.
I love Ryan White. You can put my face on a billboard with Ryan White. And the benefits that it have given me. We talked about the safety net. I am so safe with Ryan White. Ryan White covers all of my HIV-related issues from my wonderful relationship with my doctor. Also talk about the copay. I have to go have mammograms that I just present a Ryan White letter, and the copay is taken care of. My case management, you know, it's covered through Ryan White. I don't utilize Ryan White like I probably would if I wasn't working, because I would have more time. But as far as what I can do within my schedule, with my doctor's appointment, co-pays, case management, all of that, Ryan White fulfills. And that's what, you know, to be all honest, that's what I don't push myself like I need to for the marketplace, because Ryan White got me covered for those needs, you know. And just going, venturing out with the marketplace, which I'm going to process and I'm going to pursue more diligently. But there's that fear on the back of my neck that I just don't want to lose Ryan White, because it's my comfort zone. It have taken care of Shandora for 26 years, almost. You know, outside of a little time with Medicaid, on and off with Ryan White, but for the last 7 years, fully dependent and reliant on Ryan White. So, yes, I am eternally grateful to have Ryan White dealing with. And it has given me the opportunity to be up here, because never once without the Ryan White care will I be able to speak to anyone. Because I am one of those that I don't want to go to, didn't want to go to certain pharmacies. I would go 30 miles away to get my medication at one time because of the stigma. But working with Ryan White and case management, it has given me an opportunity to speak out
to be more boastful about what's going on with Shandora. Yes, I am HIV positive. HIV is part of my life. So to deal with me, you're dealing with that too. Bottom line. You know, I have accepted what's going on with Shandora today and very grateful, you know, the educational part and that come through Ryan White. And so, yes, I do thank you.
Thank you. I can't... I actually can't think of something better to end on. So please, once again, just thank our panelists and you for being here.
Talking legislature, I don't think.